Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Dr. Claire Wright is going to talk to us on the topic of Crafting the Nation, the story of a banner, a bicentennial and a birth, B-E-R-T-H, in the big house of Australian democracy. Associate Professor Wright is on the academic staff of La Trobe University in Melbourne. She's a historian, an author, most recently of Your Daughters of Freedom, and we've got some copies of Your Daughters of Freedom on sale tonight, The Australians Who Won the Vote and Inspired the World. And Dr. Wright is also presenting on radio, ABC Radio National, a history series, Shooting the Past. But for tonight, Crafting the Nation, Claire Wright, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to speak here tonight, and Jared. It's a great honour. There were a little bit of crossed wires in my preparation for tonight. I thought that I had a full hour to speak, and I now find that I have half an hour. So there might be a few bits of my well-crafted presentation tonight that I'm going to have to skip through and extemporise. Fortunately, I'm not new to public speaking. So I would first like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to any Indigenous people here tonight. I would also like to acknowledge that we are gathering on stolen land and that sovereignty was never ceded. So tonight I want to tell you a story. It's an Australian story. And the story begins in a land far, far away, on the other side of the planet in London. And it takes place at a time in our history that gets easily overlooked when we tell stories of ourselves about ourselves. That extraordinary decade or so between Federation and World War I, between the real birth of our nation and the oft-touted but empirically bogus one, which is Gallipoli. So the main protagonist in this story is not a person, but an object. And like many leading ladies in our history, the object is beautiful, valiant, and overwhelmingly forgotten. I want to tell you this story because I think it is both inherently interesting and also a cautionary tale. So let me take you to London in the sweltering summer of 1911. Australian expat artist Dora Meeson Coates could not remember an English summer that had been so hot. And fortunately, the major piece that Dora would exhibit that year was already complete. For three summers earlier, Dora, as she later recalled, had designed and painted a very large banner for the Commonwealth. A banner that, in just a few days, she would hold aloft in the event that was setting London hearts aflutter with pride and anticipation. George V would be crowned king on the 22nd of June. But his coronation would not be the only pageantry to capture the British imagination that sticky northern summer of 1911. Saturday, June 17th, 1911, will be an historic date in the annals of England, predicted the Adelaide Register. The procession of women will be the greatest witnessed in the history of the world. The Australian press watched eagerly on. The Geelong Advertiser set the scene. From the embankment, the historic starting place of arguments, by mass there is to wend today what suffragists have for months described as the great women's procession, intended to be specially representative in its character of the entire womanhood of the British Empire. So why were Britain's women taking to the streets in their tens of thousands? And three little words sum up their motivation: votes for women. One of the suffrage organisations to take part, the one that Dora Meeson Coates belonged to, the Women's Freedom League, riffed on this theme. It will be given to the people in London to witness the greatest procession ever known in the world's history. And this at a time when women's suffrage was, as one contemporary commentator put it, the great world movement, the most insistent political problem of the day, the most significant revolution that has come over society in the first years of the 20th century. Indeed, womanhood suffrage was, at the turn of the 20th century, what Kevin Rudd might have called the great moral challenge of the generation. The significance of the procession will be worldwide, reported the London correspondent to the Adelaide Register. For the procession will not only be national in its character, but also imperial and international. Noting that Australian women were enfranchised in the coronation year of Edward VII, the journalist predicted that the crowning glory of the coronation year of King George V will be the emancipation of the women at the heart and the centre of the empire. So, the organisers' prophecies of greatness came true. 40,000 women united in their demand for that which the British Parliament, including its current Liberal government, consistently failed to grant them, the right to vote. And they gathered together in this show of incredible determination and strength. And the procession was 4 miles long, stretching from the Houses of Parliament on the Westminster Embankment to the Albert Hall. It took 5 hours for the full procession to pass at any given point. Tens of thousands of women walking five abreast, with pennants flying, this is a quote, banners held aloft, colours of every hue and shade and gradation blazing in the sun. And cheering crowds lined London's streets, drawn by the sheer spectacle of it all. And it was not only English women, but women from across the globe who gathered together to demonstrate their sisterly esprit de corps. Now, Australia's contingent in the procession was headed up by no less a luminary than Margaret Fisher. She's the tall woman, 6'3", Margaret Fisher was. Wife of the Australian Prime Minister, Andrew Fisher. And Fisher was in England to take part in the Imperial Conference. Australia's most famous suffrage campaigner, Vida Goldstein, was also in London at the invitation of Mrs. Pankhurst. And Vida had assumed the mantle of organiser of the Australian contingent, reflecting her status as Australia's most internationally renowned suffragist. Vida is the woman of the moment in British suffragette circles, announced the Sydney Truth. So Australia marched at the top of the procession, along with New Zealand, in recognition of Australasia's world-leading status as democratic exemplar. In 1893, New Zealand had become the first self-governing dominion in the world to extend its franchise to women. In 1894, South Australia became the second dominion to confer the status, and went one better, giving its women, including Indigenous women, both the right to vote and to stand for Parliament. In 1902, the newly federated nation of Australia made this the gold standard for the federal franchise, though all Indigenous people lost their voting rights, a fact that drew scant criticism at the time. So on Saturday the 17th of June 1911, Vida Goldstein now proclaimed in London, "Every Australasian woman who is enfranchised in spirit as well as in the letter of the law will consider it her solemn duty to show her sympathy with the women of this country who have laboured for over 50 years for the franchise. Having won their domestic struggle to be counted, Australian women now paraded their victory on the world stage in an audacious mixture of national patriotism and empire loyalty, of colonial self-assertion and imperial interdependence." Now, Australia's world-leading status was no secret. Everybody lining the streets from the Embankment to Albert Hall knew that Australia was the first nation to give white women perfect equality with men, full adult suffrage with no property qualification. "The purest type of democracy the human race has ever known," wrote one journalist in 1903, "flourishes today beneath Australian skies." It was in recognition of this remarkable fact that the daughters of empire had outpaced the mother country, that Dora Meeson Coates had fashioned her suffrage banner. Her banner's message, painted in shouty all caps, trust the women, mother, as I have done. Now, as you can see here, the imagery Dora employed to convey this instruction was fashionably classical in its imagery, but electrifyingly impertinent in its intent. Mother Britannia, draped in white, holding her sceptre, her hip and her head cocked, staring into the middle distance, haughtily. Daughter Minerva, bearing the heraldry of the Australian Commonwealth, leading forward, reaching out, offering guidance. It was a banner replete with allegorical effrontery, signifying that which the world knew, that Australia was the nation which had, quote, pioneered women into citizenship. Again, another quote. No more striking method could have been devised for bringing Australasia into prominence, wrote one newspaper of Dora's banner. And the banner articulated what a proud Australian woman living in London described as the fact of our having proved to the world our political fitness, a fine object lesson. So what was the effect of this material message, this bold piece of Commonwealth advice, as one newspaper called Dora's work? Well, in terms of British politics, it had little influence. Prime Minister Asquith was not moved by the roaring success of the women's coronation procession, and the British women were no closer to achieving their democratic citizenship rights. These, we know in hindsight, would not be won until 1918, and then only in part to propertied women over the age of 30, another 10 years for full adult suffrage. So ultimately, Dora's banner had more to say about Australia's national life than Britain's. And part of the power of Dora's banner, why it fulfilled this function of a diplomatic missive, was the fact that it spoke not on behalf of Australia's women alone, but indeed provided the backdrop to a wider push for Australia to be taken more seriously as a sovereign nation, for Australia's voice to be heard more keenly, for her ideas to be followed more respectfully than Mother England presently tolerated. At the Imperial Conference, Andrew Fisher made a plea for closer consultation with the Dominions on matters of defence and the wisdom and the justice of social legislation that had been pioneered in Australia. Along with his fellow delegate William Lyon, they lobbied the British Parliament, the mother of parliaments, and said she could derive some advantage from the experiments in legislation made by the Australasian parliaments. Now, such urging, reverse colonising the landscape of political ideas, did not come out of the blue. Prior to the Imperial Conference, the Australian Parliament had already sent a message loud and clear that it was in the interests of imperial democracy that Britain follow Australia's lead in progressive reform measures. And that's because on the 17th of November 1910, Senator Arthur Ray introduced to Parliament an idea that Vida Goldstein had in fact been advocating to him for some time. Why not put into official words what Dora's banner communicated in popular art? And this came to pass. Dora wrote the resolution, Senator Ray presented it to Parliament. And I'll abbreviate, and the essence of the resolution is that the Senate is of the opinion that the extension of the suffrage to the women of Australia on the same terms as men has had the most beneficial results. And because the reform has brought nothing but good, though disaster was freely prophesied, we respectfully urge that all nations enjoying representative government would be well advised in granting votes to women. And this resolution was passed by the Senate, a similar one was passed in the House of Representatives, and it was duly sent to directly to Prime Minister Asquith. Although some parliamentarians were a bit squeamish about teaching the mother country how to suck eggs. So it was in this context that Dora's banner, paraded just 7 months after that resolution was passed, didn't just simply represent Australian women, it represented Australia itself. A message from the demonstrably confident and democratically superior daughter nation. Now, whether or not Australians individually or collectively had built up enough political momentum to turn the tide of British affairs, the effort had at least confirmed the young nation's self-belief in its own power and its efficacy. Dora's highly conspicuous banner had a great deal to do with helping Australia what at the time was called bulk large. We now call that skiting. It was something that Australians were recognised for at the time, bulking large, or having a lot of blow was the other expression. So that's not the end of our story. What did I do with my water? That's fine. So walk with me now through the corridors of Parliament House in Canberra, and I'll tell you what happens next. Maybe. I will. Aha. Okay. So let's walk past the Great Hall with its stunningly beautiful weaving, conceived by Arthur Ward and Arthur Boyd and executed by the Victorian Tapestry Workshop. And let's walk into the Members' Hall. Here we are, the centre of Parliament House, under the flagpole, where the portraits of our succession of Prime Ministers line the walls. Now, this photo I took a little while ago. Until late last year, there were only two women represented in this gallery, Dame Quentin Bryce and Queen Elizabeth, who we can see regaled here in what was called, she was called the Wattle Queen in her very yellow dress. Now these portraits have been somewhat shuffled around, and Julia Gillard flanks the Queen, peering out with a cheeky rascal look in her eye. And if we proceed down the narrow corridor, splitting Gillard, who's now here, from Howard, and we walk down that corridor, we will find Tom Roberts' big picture, officially known as the opening of the first Parliament of the Commonwealth of Australia by His Royal Highness of the Duke of Cornwall in York, 9th of May 1901. Hence it's known as the big picture. And that famous painting, which depicts the first sitting of the new federal parliament, is on permanent loan for the Royal Collection, because it's not easy to own your own history. Now, as you rounded that corner into the corridor, veering left at Howard or right at Gillard, that's somebody's idea of a joke, you might have noticed a framed glass case mounted on the wall. And this item... Oh, hello. This item is 2.5 metres high and 14 and a metre and a half wide. And this gives you some perspective. Despite its size, the tucked away positioning, not visible from the main hall, suggests that you needn't dally in the passageway en route to the big picture. But if you do stop here, you'll find this national treasure, Dora Mason Coates' banner. And unlike the big picture, it's owned by the Australian people, it represents the achievements of the Australian people, and it's almost completely unknown to the vast majority of Australian people. I wonder how many of you here tonight know about it. And the story of how Dora Mason Coates' banner travelled from her studio in Chelsea to a corridor in Canberra is both delightful and pathetic. And I'm going to abbreviate that story, but you can read more about it on the Sydney Institute papers when it's published later on. So as we have seen, the world's press lauded her banner, and it was singled out as a highlight of a singular event. And then it completely disappeared. And what happens next forms the cautionary part of this tale. So in an extensive research journey, I found no mention of a sighting of the banner for another 75 years after that hot June day in 1911. And then in May 1987, the Australian historian Dale Spender, who was then living in London, accidentally happened across it at the Fawcett Library, which is a specialist collection relating to British women's history, including suffrage memorabilia. It's now housed at the London School of Economics. And so the Fawcett Library was clearing out its storerooms for renovations, and they unearthed Dora Mason Coates' artwork. And they showed it to the curators at the Museum of London, and they said, it's such a beautifully painted and well-designed banner. This is a curator at the museum. It's unique to the Commonwealth, a unique banner in a uniquely good condition. And Spender was thrilled. So the librarians had found this uncatalogued banner folded up, gathering dust, on top of a cupboard. And they didn't know anything about its provenance, but they registered the historical and commercial value of suffragette banners generally, and so they sent it to be restored. And the banner was distinctive. I think I've got a few images here which will show if they'll catch up with me. Yes, you can see that What was distinctive about it was that it was in fact oil painted on Hessian, because Meeson Coates was an oil painter, and all the other suffragette banners were in fact embroidered. And possibly due to this fact, the Conservatives botched the restoration, and they rendered the banner solid, and it could no longer be folded up or rolled, and the library didn't have the room to store it or the facility to exhibit it. And so they thought that it was the most appropriate thing that the banner went home. And so Dale Spender then wrote to the Commonwealth Government making a case for the banner's return to Australia. And it's really interesting that the documentation is infused with this language of repatriation, though the banner was clearly made in London and it wasn't boomeranging back to Australia in any way. The timing was good. Australia was celebrating its bicentenary the following year. And as one bureaucrat in the Office for the Status of Women pointedly observed, the Commonwealth possessed no other item for display in Parliament House related to women's suffrage or the women's movement in Australia. Indeed, subsequent protracted negotiations over the buyback, as it was called, of the banner, revealed the problem of a lack of objects or artworks relating to women in Parliament House or in national collections more generally. And they believed that this banner would go somewhere towards filling the gap as a record of women's part in the early political process of this country. So, to cut a long story short, in the second half of 1987, Spender facilitated discussions with the Fawcett Library and the Office for the Status of Women, and in the end, the Bicentennial Committee put... They actually tried to get Britain to donate it, as a gift, a bicentennial gift to the people of Australia, but that didn't happen. And so Australia, if they wanted the banner, they had to find the purchase price themselves. And through the National Women's Consultative Committee, by funds through the Australian Bicentennial Authority, it was brokered, and the banner was purchased as, and these are important words, a gift to the women of Australia. Now, there's a lot of commentary about it coming back. James Mollison, the director of the National Gallery, was thrilled because he said it had been thought until now in artistic circles that the banner had been lost or destroyed completely, and it was very exciting for them to be able to see her greatest artwork on display. But not everybody was excited by the move. Dear sisters, wrote Di Lucas of the ACT to the National Women's Consultative Committee, I wish to express my outrage. Collusion with the ABA is collusion with invasion and genocide. I support the sovereignty of the Aboriginal people and regard the 1988 celebrations as an exercise in crass commercialisation and nationalism, colonialism and racism. And Sue Hurd, writing for the Women Against Racism Collective, was similarly incensed. We would like to draw your attention to the fact that by celebrating 200 years of white invasion of Australia, you fail to acknowledge the Aboriginal people. Now, none of the angry sisters pointed out, however, that it was only white Australian women whose victories the banner celebrated. The Franchise Act of 1902 that gave Australian women their historic democratic rights also stripped all Indigenous Australians of their citizenship rights. So nationalism, colonialism and racism, in Di Lucas's words, had always been integral to the banner's history. So the banner arrived back in Canberra on the 12th of February 1988, and on the 8th of March, International Women's Day, Prime Minister Bob Hawke officiated at an historic handover, they called it, ceremony at the Lodge. And in the front of a crowd that included politicians and journalists and members of the Meeson family, Hawke unveiled the banner. And in his speech, he referred to Australian women's role in the forefront of the achievement of franchise rights. And the official rationale for the $25,000 public spend was broad. The banner would, quote, remind and inform women of their political and social history and the need for continued and renewed involvement in the political process. So note here that the object lesson that Dora's banner was reminding the world in 1911 had now been transformed into a history lesson that only Australian women must heed. Silly Sheilas forgetting how important they once were. So after the fuss of the handover on the 8th of March 1988, there was a mob of angry female protesters outside the lodge, raising their own anti-bicentennial placards. The banner was whisked off for conservation work at the National Gallery of Australia. And it was still there over a year later when Senator Margaret Reynolds, who had been instrumental in bringing the banner back, began to make inquiries about its whereabouts. And another 6 months later, it was located in a storage unit and no conservation work had been done. In February 1990, the National Museum of Australia agreed to conserve the banner, but they wanted to keep it for themselves, which Parliament House wouldn't allow that to happen, and so more protracted negotiations. And eventually an agreement was struck that the National Museum would restore it and the Parliament would house it. But the final resting place of the banner was always contentious. Would it be subsumed in other examples of women's craft in New Parliament House, like the tapestries, or would it be located alongside portraits of Andrew Fisher and Alfred Deakin, those who were Dora and Vida's contemporaries? And the architects for the new Parliament House proposed that it was permanently exhibited in the foyer to the main committee room, where they said it would have a close conceptual relationship with the historical period of the opening of Parliament, paintings located there. Therefore, it should go next to Tom Roberts' painting, The Big Picture. In the end, the final say went to the textile conservators, who were concerned about lighting conditions, and it found its final resting space in the public pause space, that is the corridor. I think in the 30 years since it came home, the banner has become untethered from its remarkable story. When, in mid-2017, I asked the keepers of the banner at Parliament House for information about the object's provenance, they knew nothing beyond its title, its creator, and its dimensions. So why should we be concerned about this now? It's a miracle that the banner survived at all, and it's now safely ensconced at Parliament House. Isn't this enough? Well, I don't think it is. The story of the Trust the Women banner is not about provenance. It's about politics. For as I hope I've demonstrated tonight, the story that the banner tells is the story of our nation, not just our nation's women. And as the bicentennial protesters suggested in their own blinkered way, the narrative is not trouble-free. This is the story of how the world's newest nation became a global exemplar, exporting to the world a model of democracy that was, at once, ahead of its time and perfectly of the moment. In Federation Australia, it was no longer gender, but race, which would test the limits of citizenship. So how do we tell this story today, 117 years after Australia's women threw their Indigenous sisters under the bus, while they sailed off to help their less fortunate British sisters, that's what they called them, in their struggle for equality? How do we both shout, as feminists still need to do to be heard, and listen, as Indigenous Australians are so patiently and so patently asking us all to do? Now, I think founding documents and defining objects are important in answering such questions. Americans have their Constitution, Declaration of Independence, and Bill of Rights, known collectively as the Charters of Freedom, and on public display in Washington, D.C. While Australia has a written constitution, it's not fetishised in nearly the same way. We don't have a treaty with our First People, as New Zealand does, and we don't have a national flag free of colonial symbolism, as Canada does. Founding documents say something about our values, our principles, and what we represent and hold to be self-evident. But no one piece of paper or object can carry this weight. Complex, multifaceted, multiracial, multicultural democracies like ours require a trousseau of heirlooms, not the crown jewels. And I am convinced that the story of the banner has a patriotic as well as a gendered dimension. Patriotism is about finding a way to feel and express love for your country. To love your country, you must understand that you belong to it, that you are woven into its fabric, that it holds you in mind. Now, Indigenous educator Hayley Maguire has written recently, just last week, about how she felt when she sat in her grade 4 history class and heard her teacher tell the students that Captain Cook discovered Australia and that the country was founded as a nation of convicts. As an Aboriginal child sitting in that classroom, McQuire says, I felt erased. She felt expunged from her country's story not by a bad teacher, but as she says, by design. And just as educational syllabi have been used as a tool of colonisation, so the architects of memorialisation and commemoration reaffirm the values and the objectives of the society of the day. I'll repeat, Dora Meeson Banner tells the story of the nation, not just the nation's women. The history of women's political activism is more than just the decorative ornamentation on the real story of national generation and regeneration. And in this context, the bicentennial can be seen as an intellectual stocktake of the nation's principles and aspirations. The fact that Bob Hawke made a bicentennial gift of Dora's beautiful banner to the women of Australia reflects the misguided notion that women are peripheral to past successes and failures of Australian democracy rather than intrinsic to its composition and its constitution. Now, in conclusion, lest you think me a latter-day member of the Shrieking Sisterhood, that charming name by which Australia's suffragists were known, let me leave you with a concrete example of the effect of such marginalisation. In 2002, the centenary of Australia's white women achieving their world-leading citizenship rights, Senator Amanda Vanstone launched a design competition to build a fitting memorial. The winning design was selected by a jury comprising no less than the former National Gallery director Betty Churcher, the director of the South Australian Art Gallery Ron Radford, and Anna Waldman, head of the Australian Council's Visual Arts Board. Their winning design was appropriately massive and spectacular, reflecting the enormity of the feat that had been achieved. An 18-metre tall red steel sculpture shaped as a fan with 10 rotating blades. Vanstone had earmarked the place for the memorial on the lawn behind Old Parliament House, in line with the steps of New Parliament House and the War Memorial. A year later, amidst controversy and secrecy, Amanda Vanstone's office, the Office for the Status of Women, announced that the contract with the artists had been cancelled. That's why I can't show you a picture of it. The primary objection appears to be that the chosen position was too prominent and might possibly obscure views of the war memorial. That's a quote. One of the artists, Jennifer Turpin, lamented it was very important as a statement about our democracy that it should be on that site. We are talking about half the population of Australia here. Now, I challenge you in the room today to tell me where the subsequent memorial fountain that was built, it's more like a fish pond, celebrating the centenary of women's suffrage in Australia, is hidden. We need monuments to the women who not only won monumental democratic rights for our citizens, but also fought for these liberties on the world stage, in the heat of other nations' battles, because they were aware of their profile and potency as leaders in a global movement for justice. We need monuments to their courage, their vision and tenacity, obstinacy and resolve that has without doubt benefited our nation. We need a tangible, concrete, permanent and prominent reminder of what our nation once was, a leader, not a follower, punching above its weight in politics, not just sport, and what it could be again. Now, there's a lot of talk these days about tearing down statues. I don't want to tear down statues. I want to build more of them. I want our cities and our suburbs and our federal capital to build new statues to new heroes, those who have been previously discounted from our nation's story and those who could provide role models, inspiration and understanding for generations to come. In an age of Instagram, Snapchat and Twitter, with their implied transience and superficiality, I want to fill our city streets with bronze and marble and stone and wood. I want to see our high streets transformed into new avenues of honour, venerating the women and men who pioneered our brave new democracy, the women and men who challenged the limits of that half-cocked citizenship, the women and men who are still fighting to expand the definition of what it means to count, to belong, and to have a voice in our nation today. Our nation is blessed with artists and craftspeople who have the creativity and the skill to render in material form the ideas, the hopes, and the ambitions of our forefathers and mothers, our elders, black and white, male and female, gay and straight, past, present, and emerging. Such monuments would tell stories and start conversations about the ideas and forces that have made modern Australia. Stories of colonialism and post-colonialism, of imperialism and republicanism, of genocide and assimilation, of war and of peace, of exclusion and inclusion, of alienation and belonging. Why don't we have statues to our suffrage leaders, like the one of Emmeline Pankhurst that stands in St. Peter's Square in Manchester? Or a National Women's History Museum, like the one that will open in the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in 2020 to celebrate the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And for my money, the first of these new monuments, the first cab off the rank in a capital investment in the intellectual rigour and cultural maturity of our nation, will be a statue to Vida Goldstein. It should sit out the front of Victoria's Parliament, the place of our first federal parliament, a place where she was both at home and in the wilderness, knocking at the door, as Tony Abbott once referred to the women who were not included in his famous one-woman cabinet. And to begin the process of raising the profile of women's representation, their activism in our participatory democracy, we could do worse than reposition Dora Mason Coates' remarkable banner to a more prominent position within Parliament House, a location befitting its historical significance, a location that invites viewers to stop and look at it and digest its meaning, not walk on by en route to the big picture. The question I think is most pertinent and with which I'd like to conclude tonight is this. How will we, as a nation, value our founding documents, the material legacy of our complicated and still contested democracy? Will we continue to largely represent the progenitors of our nation as fallen soldiers via our nation's most handsomely funded mausoleum of past virtues, the War Memorial? Or will we find a place in our hearts and our federal budgets to elevate and amplify the story of the civic road to a complicated and contested nationhood? Is it in our national benefit to continue to peddle the empirically fallacious notion that Gallipoli was the birth of the nation? Or would we be better off admitting a few new heroes and heroines to the pantheon of nation builders? Might our participatory democracy and our civic institutions be more respected than they currently are, more participatory than they currently are, more representative than they currently are, as we're told in the papers every day, more reflective of the demographic composition of modern Australia if our historic landmarks and aide de memoire more accurately represented the true story of us? And might we craft a more robust, courageous, independent nation in the future if we commit to unravelling the threads of the past? That's all I have for you.
So many thanks to Professor Wright. We've got some copies of your Daughters of Freedom, the Australians who won the vote and inspired the world, and that's got some very fine illustrations, including of the Dora Mason Coates famous banner. So now we come to questions discussion. We've got about 20 minutes to go. Can I start off by asking, I mean, obviously what happened with women's suffrage didn't happen by accident. So why was it that the lead here came from New Zealand and the Australian colonies and then the Commonwealth of Australia rather than Britain or the United States? Was it the fact that because this was a new settlement, it didn't bring it with it a lot of the traditions of the past was very empirical, or were there other more deep philosophical reasons? How would you see that?
Well, you've to a certain extent answered your own question, in that, yes, it was very much to do with these being new nations, at the time dominions, when it happened, that were free of many of the orthodoxies and conventions of the past, proud to be so, looking forward to the idea that this place that they were building in the Antipodes was the place of the future. And it was very much part of the idea of Australia's initial nationhood that we were the nation of the future. And I think that there's an extremely interesting, let's put this down, convergence. And this is really my theory of why Australia. I mean, there are some technical aspects about why South Australia got the vote when it did, and they are all told in the book, and not all of them are high-minded philosophical ones by any means. Actually, South Australian women got the vote because of the biggest political belly flop in history, when a very conservative member of the South Australian upper house included an amendment at the last minute that he thought was going to sink the suffrage bill, which in fact not only gave women the right to vote but the right to stand for parliament. That was the amendment that he put forward because he thought nobody in their right mind would go for that. So it was partly a series of fortunate events, partly then that what Australia did with that was this convergence of feminism, the international feminism, this great world movement, as I've described, and the particular local circumstances of federalism. So this is the time when Australia is, the Australian colonies are working out what this nation is going to stand for, what powers it's going to have, who is going to belong in it, what the individual colonies are going to give up. And one thing that South Australia says it will not give up is the gold standard of franchise that it has. And by this stage, remember that South Australian women are voting women, so they have voted for the delegates to the South Australian Constitutional Convention. And those delegates are very aware that they are having to play to their voters. And then by the time the Constitution is brought in, Western Australian women are now voting as well, also through a bit of political expediency on behalf of John Forrest. But we do have this situation where South Australia now holds the federal nation to ransom, saying that if South Australian women lose any of their rights, South Australia won't join the Federation. So essentially women's suffrage is made a precondition of a federated Australia. And Australian women have been very collective. I can point to leaders like Vida Goldstein, but it was a collective movement. It was a long-term struggle. They were incredibly organised. They were incredibly articulate. They knew what they were doing. They knew what they wanted, and they were great lobbyists and able to put pressure on men who ultimately were the ones who had to make change happen. So I like to refer to men like Frederick Holder, who was a South Australian who was at the South Constitutional Convention, and men like Alfred Deakin, as what we now would call male champions of change. None of it happens without them, because no legislation, no bill can be put up in Parliament without a man putting it forward and men voting on it. But it was the women in the background lobbying. So it's partly that Australia is cognizant of its place in the world, the place that it wants to hold, which is as this new dawn of humanity on the turn of the 20th century, which is supposed to be the women's century, and that women are pressing their particular advantage here in Australia home. And the really interesting thing is that all of the men, the male politicians, people like Edmund Barton, who becomes Australia's first Prime Minister, but was an extreme anti-suffrage proponent. As soon as the tables have turned and women's suffrage is part of the federated Australia, then they quickly jump ship, and now they're all the greatest exponents of suffrage that the world has ever seen. And simple reason, because women now vote for them.
Thank you very much. Give us a great presentation, and thank you for letting me ask you questions. It's very interesting. I mean, I didn't know Australia, the first country, gave their suffrage, I mean, to women. But I'm not going to ask you that question, because I have to read your book before I can. But I want to ask you a question in general about women, how a woman in the history get their political suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look in from the Greek Roman time,
okay.
a woman has been denied that political rights for centuries, for 3,000 years. So why suddenly in after 3,000 years, like, you know, and that happened in the particular time, also in Europe, do you think, except all those people, you know, the active politician, you know, the movement, are there other factors, say, example, scientific and technology factor? Because when the Europe, you know, had that... Europe that had a leap forward in science, and you invented the automation and home appliances, and that helps woman, a free woman from the household. Thank you very much.
Okay. So I think I get the gist of the question, which is what happens after 3,000 years that of women's oppression that there starts to be a movement for women's suffrage in the first place. So it really comes down to what was going on in the 19th century, which was the expansion of the franchise in general. So it wasn't only women who were oppressed, but also propertyless men. And it was the 1832 Reform Acts in Britain that opened the franchise for the first time to extend voting rights to a wider range of men. Now, this then, I guess, if you were going to draw a timeline, you could go to the 1848, which was called the Year of Revolutions. And all over Europe, monarchies are being challenged by the forces of democracy, by the people. So the 19th century is known as the People's Century, where people are all of those kind of structures of hierarchy, of orthodoxy, of power that kept people... disenfranchised was starting to be broken down. And then you can move the next step to Australia, which is the Gold Rush. The book before this, it's not my first book, but the book before this is The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, which is about the Gold Rush time and Australia's particular Australian women's role in Eureka. And one of the things that I found in that research is that there were women who were advocating the suffrage at the time. There were women who were part of British Chartism that were advocating universal suffrage, but that was dropped, again, out of political expediency, thinking, you know, men weren't going to get greater rights if they tried to bring women along with them. So women were thrown under the bus. And so slowly, you know, that happens. More and more people around the world are stepping out of these more orthodox structures. Men are getting the vote, and then women start to say, but hang on, if former slaves can vote, if black former slaves can vote, and we're talking about America now as well, why can't we fine, upstanding, educated women also be given these rights? And it becomes a matter of justice. John Stuart Mill writes On Liberty. He writes at the same time The Subjugation of Women with his much-forgotten wife. And so these ideas are in play. And Australia is really in the New World, Gerald was saying, with New Zealand in the New World, these ideas could grasp on because the old notions of prejudice, the forces that were rallying against populism and democratic expansion weren't as firmly rooted. And there's also another theory that Australian women as pioneers of white settlement had earned more respect from their men because they had more of an economic role to play in most Australian families as well. So I hope that goes somewhat towards answering your question, and it was really just about the fact that different countries within their own historical circumstances were all having to find the solution to this most pressing problem, which was, and what about the women?
What about science? We've got to move on. There's a question over here. Yes?
I was just wondering, I was very interested when you said in 1894 that Indigenous women got the vote as well as white women. Mm-hmm. What about the men, the Indigenous men?
They did as well.
Did they have the vote?
Yes, they already had the vote in South Australia,
right.
And that's why when women's suffrage came in, Indigenous women did as well.
Right.
And because women achieved the same voting rights as men.
And then that all went by in 1902.
Correct.
In Federation.
Yes.
Was not even considered? Or?
Oh, no, it was very highly considered, and probably the most difficult chapter of this book that I had to write was, and to research, was going through Hansard and reading the proceedings of the debates into the Franchise Act. Because there were a great number of the MPs who were straight out saying, hang on, we can't take citizenship rights away from our Indigenous Australians. They didn't call them that at the time. They called them our Aborigines, usually. Or, and this is why it was difficult to read. Much worse terms that I'm not going to repeat tonight. And that there were these people saying, we've already taken their land off them. We've already stripped them of their culture. Now what, we're going to take their citizenship rights as well? But then there were so many other opposing forces to that, arguing in the most racially vilified terms that you can imagine what would be the disastrous effect of allowing black people to vote in Australia. And, you know, cautionary tale to our politicians now. Historians read Hansard. And in 100 years' time, the things that our elected representatives are saying in our name today will be there for for historians to judge in the future. And what I've tried to do in that chapter is basically give the sources as openly as possible, and people can make their own judgments about the language and about the sentiments that are expressed. So yes, some people were arguing against it, but because it was tied up with this whole, the Franchise Act was also the act that was giving women the right to vote, and that was seen as being a much more important step to be taking, then those people who were supporting Indigenous rights basically in the end stepped back because they didn't want to see the whole bill scuttled. And as we know, it would take until the 1960s before they got them back again.
This may be the last question. We'll see how we go. Up the back.
I just want to clear up. In terms of the states, there were states that allowed Indigenous voting, I think, because in 19, they could vote in the states. And that's my other question. When we brought in suffrage for women so early in the Federation, why did it take so long in the different states to follow the lead?
Yeah. Okay, so the federal franchise came in 1902. New South Wales followed quite quickly after that. And then it was kind of like bowling, and the pins all eventually fell according to the particular personalities in the states at the time and the particular intransigence of the upper houses. Because women's suffrage bills had been being put up in Australian colonial parliaments since the 1880s. In their 10s and 20s and 30s, you know, there were just dozens of them that were put up. They all passed through the lower houses, the People's House, without any trouble at all. They got stymied in the upper house, and the upper house was still the propertied house. It wasn't a fully democratic house. So it represented property interests, and it represented the most intransigent of the established. So they had the most power to lose in that sense. And ironically, it was Victoria, which was the last state to give women the right to vote, my own home state, in 1908. And this was the state that Vida Goldstein was from, and that she had worked her whole life for this. And it's part of the narrative of the book. The book, I should say, is about five Australian women who go to England to work for the rights of their less fortunate British sisters and who become involved in the British suffragette movement. Another story that has been left out of the telling, if you saw, you know, the suffragette movie or you read most of the books that are published in England, you won't know about the role of Australians, but it was very prominent. And that's really what most of the book is about. And Vida didn't go until 1911, even though she'd been asked to come much earlier than that. And that's because she stayed at home in Victoria just slogging it out against the Premier, really. It was almost down to a personality clash. And like Prime Minister Asquith in Britain, who just dug his heels in. I mean, he was a Liberal Prime Minister. And this was another part of the message of Dora's banner I didn't go into, is that the Liberals had come in Britain in 1905 in an absolute landslide election, wiping away the Tories, and their motto was, trust the people. So, but and all the suffragettes thought, you know, our struggle is over. It's going to happen any minute. And in 1911, they're still going for it. In 1912, and, you know, then there's the war, and then there's more stories to tell.
Look, I think that's a very good place to finish on. I know there were more questions, but we always finish on time, and that's what we're going to do tonight. So, as I said, there are copies of You Daughters of Freedom available. I'd just like to conclude by saying... thanks for cutting your speech down. The full one will be run in the Sydney papers online, but to get an academic to speak for 40 minutes is a real achievement rather than 55, so thanks for that. And we had a great Christian time, and I'm glad we did that. So congratulations on your book. I mean, it's a finely written book. It's very clearly written and very strongly argued, but it's a great book, and thanks for your presentation tonight, which has been terrific, and good luck for the future.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.